Gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 31st day of October 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and it is a great pleasure to be here presenting you this most important of broadcasts. I am honored to bring back a friend of mine, somebody I've worked with extensively in the past, somebody I rely on He cautions me. He advises me. He's been doing the research on many of these very important subjects we discuss for many years. He spent his life in service to his country. His work with the movement that we're all involved in here has been profound. And his name is Barry Turner, Colonel, retired. He's from Britain, and it's my pleasure to have him on today. Barry, are you with me?
Yes, I am indeed, yes.
Well, we talked a little bit, Barry, about this, this position that we're all finding ourselves in with political correctness and how it's used to silence critics. And you've done a little bit of research on what's been happening in Britain, but I dare say that's a worldwide phenomenon, and we're not even allowed anymore to take an opposing view to issues such as homosexuality on grounds of religion, or on the vulgarity we're seeing on our televisions, or all of these things, because to do so runs afoul of some sort of political correctness. And you want to give a little bit of the background that you were discovering when you looked into this?
Yes. When I look at the amount of stuff that's been written on these various subjects, of course, we go back into history, which is something that we discussed the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you go back? Almost to the beginning of time, if you can identify time.
Yeah.
And there is one looks in the end for a thread of continuity here. Now, it's very difficult because you go back into the sort of to the age of the Knights Templar, the Crusades,
right,
the Rosicrucians, through Freemasonry in the early 17th century. And you're looking for the continuity. One has to ask, well, circumstances change, the world changes. Is there a continuous thread here? And some of it has to do with almost with the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
But I started, of course, I'm not an expert, with apologies to you.
Well,
I only started 20 years ago, just before I retired.
Yeah.
And it was a fluke that I happened to meet somebody, one could almost say it was prophetic, who was an expert herself, a retired scientist, who had spent her time unearthing some of these sinister influences.
Yep.
Both historical and in the political field. Now, in those days, was rather like somebody on the rim of a wheel.
Mm-hmm.
The people who knew it all and had worked on this sort of thing for years were at the hub, and
yep,
I was sort of on the end of a spoke. Now, sadly, these people, one by one, have died off, and I find myself in the middle, in the hub.
Yes, you are.
But you see, one of the things I've missed, and it's inevitable with the passage of time, I was not around in the 1920s. I was not around in the 1930s. I was a boy in the 1940s. And crucial periods, these formative periods in recent history, fairly modern history, of course, I had no contact with. Now, I was fortunate, of course, in knowing people who had been involved. Now, these were the people who taught me. But one of the things that I find in looking into any of this is that, of course, you come up against the conspiracy theory, conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
Now, this is a term used very glibly to rubbish anybody who's done any research, who has anything to expose. And it also, of course, draws in what I call the pseudo-historians or analysts who see a market in books and they use other material without doing much research themselves, often quote each other, in my experience, in references in bibliographies. Now, that's pretty unsound, and it doesn't do the cause any good.
Well, how about the group, Barry, that actually uses about 70 or 80% facts but intentionally takes those last bits and then sends you down a primrose path or down to some dead-end street here, and what we end up with is a story that goes nowhere and never points to the bad guys, and that's what I've been finding on the Internet mostly. And, you know, the Internet being the new median, we find more of that than any other type of deception out there.
Well, I think it's quite correct. And, of course, without doing the research as thoroughly as one is capable of doing it, then one is going to be at risk and drawing the wrong conclusions.
Mm.
And, you see, I came across an individual who claimed to have an in with the British Secret Services.
Yep.
And he had quite a reputation and written a lot of books. Now, there may be nothing wrong with him, but I went through one of the books. Technically, references to the Secret Services and the way they operate were wrong. And where the monarchy was discussed, this author hadn't a clue. Clearly, he was making mistakes which should never have been made. Now, they were fundamental. Now, either he was rushing his work, or he didn't know what he's talking about, and he was just making a name by writing these books. But if we look at the subject we're covering, and you are not getting down to the core of this yet, there must be thousands of books written over the years, books going back certainly to the 17th and 18th century, the 19th century, which one needs to study.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in studying anything like this, we have to follow the references, the cross-references. It's no good reading a book and saying, that is it. What you have to do is pick up the references and follow them up, the bibliography, the supporting evidence.
Well, and find out if they're just doing each other's work together. In other words, when I looked at Captain Archibald Ramsay's work, and now of course he's an Eton graduate, Royal Military College, Sandhurst, was one of the he was a member of the Majesty's Scottish bodyguards. In fact, this guy. His record is impeccable. When he wrote his story down in that Nameless War book, it was so powerful, Barry. I was floored by the quality of his of work and the simplicity of it. He didn't mire you in useless paragraphs. He went right to the heart of every matter. And, you know, this guy wasn't writing a novel. He was writing a factual account of what he found.
Yes, this is quite right. I mean, it's a slim volume. It's a well worthwhile read. And another one, of course, is George Knupfer, Struggle for World Power, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
He was the son of a Tsarist intelligence officer. And I spoke to him once. He died several years ago. But I know other people who actually worked with him. And this was another slim volume, excellently, very well written, which is all about the fate of the Soviet Union, or the fate of Russia before it became the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
They were a developing country. And, of course, all we get is a one-sided view of Russia as it was under the Tsar,
mm-hmm.
Of peasant oppression and so on and so forth. But they were an industrializing country. They were the supplier of wheat. They were massive exporters of wheat. Now, this sort of thing you're not told, and one has to ask why. But if I can look at the continuity factor for a moment, because this is very interesting. You see, one has to say, where is the thread running through all this? Now, if you take the Bilderberg Group, which most people have heard of, you find that Lord Carrington was one of the founder members in 1954. Now, Lord Carrington is well into his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Clark, a Conservative Party politician who's held ministerial office, has become the regular attender. Now, I believe there's continuity here. Carrington is no longer able to. Clark is a regular attender. Now, that doesn't mean to say a one-off. Tony Blair went on a one-off meeting, a one-off invitation. Now, that, rather like Clinton and others, that, I suspect, and I'm certain, on the evidence, was to vet him as a future prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Gordon Brown has been. Now, one has to say, well, and Blair denied it in Parliament on the basis he wasn't actually party leader. This is when John Smith was leading the party.
Right.
And, of course, I can only speak for my country, and, you know, one has to interpret this for the United States.
Well, I know that Mulroney from Canada was invited at least once. You were right in Clinton having gone there.
Yes.
They also have this guy named John Warner, the
yes.
senator from Virginia, show up at a Bilderberg.
Mm.
And, you know, but there's a lot of mystery around Bilderberg, and I believe there's a lot of misreporting going on about that group as well. And this looks like to me, Barry, that they're just the action arm of the real power. They're the people who are carrying out the first tier work.
Mm.
But there is a group above these folks, it seems to me, from my research.
Yes. Well, my great mentor, I won't mention it, I can't mention his name, in fact, but I learned my communism, Soviet communism, at his feet, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite clear that as likely as not, the obvious thing was that the front runners are the Bilderberg Group. They'd be more and more exposed. At one time, there was very little publicity about them. Now, behind that would be more obscure groups. Now, I wouldn't know how it all fits together because, again, there's so much that one can't be an expert on everything and one can't do all the research.
Right.
If you take the Aspen Institute, the Group
yep.
of 30, you see, you don't hear about these. The Tavistock Institute, you
of
don't
course.
Hear about these.
Yep.
If I can go back to the Bilderberg, you see, I would say the socialist representative, in that he was a friend of Harold Wilson,
mm-hmm.
and I think he held office under Wilson, was Eric Rohl. Now, Eric Rohl came from an East European Jewish family. He was an immigrant, a refugee during the war.
Mm-hmm.
He worked in the city, which is an interesting one, a key point, and he became Lord Rohl of Ibston. Now, he's died now, I think. Now, who do we find coming up behind? Peter Mandelson.
Mm-hmm.
And he's become the regular. I believe this is handing over the baton in the relay race. Well, hardly a race.
Well, and Mendelssohn is also from the Jewish community as well.
Well, he happens to be. Now, you see, Mendelssohn has lost parliamentary office three times, I think.
Yep.
Over various scandals. And where does he turn up? As the European Trade Commissioner. Now, what
mm-hmm.
the hell are we playing at, you see? And people have been conditioned to accept this. They're only told what the media see fit to tell them. No fuss is made about it. Now, Mandelson is linked closely to Sir Evelyn de Rothschild,
yep.
which brings
yep.
him into contact with Kissinger and the Bilderberg Group. Now, he is also friendly with the Italian wife of Lord Jonathan Powell. Now, as Jonathan Powell, who's got many directorships now, and here we go again, Jonathan Powell was the private secretary to Margaret Thatcher. Charles Powell, his brother Jonathan, has carried out a similar or same function to Tony Blair.
Well, now, how did Miranda get his position? Was it because he was easy to control? And now I'm going into this, baiting you with this with Miranda.
Yes, you are.
For those who don't know who Miranda is, and that isn't your rights in America, you know, when you have your Miranda rights. We're talking about what the backbenchers and people in quiet corners would call Tony Blair in Parliament. Am I correct?
Not quite correct. I mean, he has been called Bambi Blair. Don't ask me why. interesting. No, a renegade. She's a bit of a renegade. A Clarissa Dixon Wright was lawyer or barrister in the same chambers as Blair.
Yep.
And in two newspapers, she said that Blair was known as, what do we call him?
Miranda.
Yeah. And that he was very friendly with the young male staff.
Yep.
Again, it is a comment which had appeared in papers, and you know, there it is.
Well, but see, Barry, before we go on, there is subsequent supporting evidence of this, that he was meeting with a male prostitute in the United States who had been getting into the White House to do press briefings under an assumed name named Jeff Gannon.
Yes.
And he actually had a 2.5-hour private meeting with him where this guy Gannon did not subsequently write any articles. And it just so happens he has a prostitute ring in Washington, D.C. Mm. Now, that would lend a little bit of circumstantial credibility to the Miranda charge as well, wouldn't it?
Well, it is all there. It is circumstantial, and all one can do is say, this is what is. The reports on Miranda were published in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
I think one was the Daily Telegraph. I forget what the other one was. It might have been the Guardian. But you see, they saw fit to publish. This is the important thing.
Yep.
Now, let's take another one, which shows you that there's a world up there which is above the, shall we say, the ordinary democratic political principles.
Mm-hmm.
You can forget democracy up there. They are the movers and shakers, the power brokers. I'll give you an example where in the upper echelons, they stand out. They're not all in it, shall we say, not all in the plot. Now, there were four successive chiefs of defense staff. The first
yep.
two were field marshals, and I knew them both.
Mm-hmm.
The next one was General Lord. He became Lord Guthrie. They all became Lords. General Lord Guthrie, and the next one was an admiral. Now, of those, you see, three of them went to employment that you'd expect, you know, some fairly lucrative directorships in the defense industry or in,
mm-hmm.
in companies associated with defense.
Mm-hmm.
This is a common progression.
Okay.
Guthrie, Lord Guthrie, became a director of N.M. Rothschild and a member of the Trilateral Commission. Now, this is a different ball game altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But if you line them up and say these are three, four chiefs of defense staff, the ordinary man in the street wouldn't suspect any difference between them.
That's right.
You know, they'd reach senior rank, all very able people, but you have this anomaly. And this you find through society, I think.
But does this connect the military-industrial complex to this group as well, in your view, or at least in a rather well? I mean, look, I have to say that war is making money for somebody, and if clearly in America, these so-called neocons who happen to be principally from a single group, they're profiting handsomely. We've got the industrial complex making lots of money off this Iraqi thing.
Well, I think if you didn't have war, then you'd have to find something else, because these clearly, particularly the United States, not so much in this country, although we have, you know, major armaments manufacturers, and a lot of it is in the sort of security business as well, the mercenary sort of approach.
Mm-hmm.
But they are employing people. They are keeping in business towns and cities in this country where they're based. Now, without them, what do you do? Do you cull the workforce that you don't need?
Well, how about returning the money? How about returning that printed money to the hands of the public and having them spend it on leisure vacations or fixing their yard or putting a new
yes.
roof on it or food for some starving yeah. homeless person?
Well, of course, the people who profit, as we know, from war are the multinational corporations,
yeah.
the bankers.
That's right.
You need a war because you either use your equipment, your military equipment, in battle, or it goes obsolete,
mm-hmm.
And you have to replace it. Now, you see, it produces a need to replace it, a justification for the military-industrial complex. I mean, it's well known, you know, in this country, well, amongst people like myself, in terms of the United States. As I say, it's a lesser profile here. Because it's massive, of course, in the United States, and without garrisons around the world,
yeah,
without operations to shall we say, exhaust the supply of equipment on, bombs, bullets, and everything else, the ammunition. What are you going to do?
Yes, but do they have a link that can be identified between, let's say, Warburg or Schiff or Loeb or Kahn or Goldsmith or Levy, or I mean, I know that the Brooks family right now is being brought on the carpet for fraud in the supplying of body armor to the military. But we know that the major stockholders of these companies are not identified in some instances. And what Mohammed Rafiq and I have discovered.
Yes.
Is that many of these shareholders are held in trust, and you don't get to know who really is holding the keys to the castle, as it were.
Yes.
Basically, you get what the front of the document says, but who's really pulling the strings from behind is often obscured.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is very true. I mean, you have to do a lot of digging around. I did this about 15 years ago, analyzing company annual reports, and you build up a network of names. You draw up a grid, and I drew the companies, including the media, across the top, and the names down the side, and put in crosses where individuals were directors of companies, and it produces an interesting pattern. And this is where you find, of course, that much of the media are linked in through directorships, in the case of the United Kingdom terminology, through directorships to the media, to the banks, to the various elements of industry, and so on and so forth.
So a lot of board members on media companies are actually sitting on let's say, Halliburton or on Bechtel or on Shell.
Yes. And you'll find the same thing with Monsanto. And you also had, for instance, Lord Carrington again. He's not the only one by any means. Lord Carrington was on the board as a European advisor, I think the term was, of one of the big American banks. I can't remember which. It's one of your, you know, major banks. Now, this is quite common. Now, if you take Peter Sutherland, another Bilderberger, and I think trilateral commissioner, an Irishman, you see, he, again, is tied up with British Petroleum and Goldman Sachs.
Uh-huh.
Now, you're looking at boards that are international, and this is the national flavor of these things. Now, these people don't get a great deal of publicity. When they do, it's fairly sanitized with favorable interviews in say, the financial pages of the press. But basically, the media are linked into this. And, of course, we are told only what the media see fit to tell us.
Well, let's ask this question. How, I mean, there was some real, this is an interesting one to open up here for you, Barry. The BBC is supposed to be public trust. It's supposed to be held as a public company that is serving the needs of the British, population. Well, what we know that when BBC was actually doing its job, especially on the David Kelly case, the politicos came out from the woodwork and absolutely savaged the director, who is, by the way, being, as we speak, being resurrected as a hero for fighting with these politicos. Excuse me. But even the supposedly public trusts of media are in these hands. It's the same in France with the France 3 television, which is supposed to be government-owned. I pay taxes for that every year. I have to pay a hundred and something euro tax to Channel 3, and yet they're spreading propaganda.
Yes. Oh, yes. Because the media are captive, of course, and you find that these people are embedded in the political scene as well. Now, another point of entry is that there is no such thing as democracy. Democracy is a catchword. Now, in the United States and in this country and other countries, the listener will have to interpret it, for their own particular case. But we have two major parties, and you vote for one or the other. Now, I was talking to a retired senior officer who had been close to Westminster for a long time, many years. He now... having retired, he is still, this is when he was serving, he is still now in contact. And he said to me, we got to know each other over a drink, and when he sort of realized I knew something of what I was talking about, he said, look, he said, you can't get as much as a cigarette paper between the two political parties, Conservative and Labour. He said, all they want is power, and it's as simple as that. Now, this, when you come to this question of democracy, the public, having cast a vote, has virtually no say. We don't have referendums they do in Switzerland. And if you take a classic case, Tony Blair on Europe promised that there would be a referendum on the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 2 years later, not only was he party to reneging on this, he stalled until he left office, Gordon Brown is taking the same line. Now, what are we playing at? You know, this is not democracy. We preach this. But the two major powers, with big business and the banks, and in the United States openly, the AIPAC and the B'nai B'rith and the rest, are controlling policy.
That's right.
No,
but see, you also know, Barry, you also know, though, that the Greeks actually experimented with different forms of government. And when they when they began to write their thesis on the idea of democracy, they came up with what we call a Kyklos cycle. And that cycle is that democracy will necessarily lead to tyranny as the public, through their democratic process, votes itself into a fiscal and rut. Now, that's not telling the whole story, because I think the two-party democracy that they, what we call that today, is just basically a media-manipulated farce. But tyranny is the end result.
Well, I mean, you look at the way we've introduced democracy to Iraq. We pillaged and destroyed a people. Is this democracy? Absolute cobblers. No such thing as democracy. And the power brokers control us. In this country, an enormous amount of legislation can be passed by the statutory instrument. Acts can be varied or amended or embellished on virtually a ministerial decree without political debate. Now,
well, it's a catchword, though. I mean, see, what it does is it democracy. That, I mean, and you can see all of these poorly educated amongst us are getting all excited about the idea. But in America, we've had what we call a constitutional republic. We don't have a democracy. And what that constitution guarantees is at least a minimum level of protection against tyranny. And what we've seen over the last 8 years or 10 years, even, or even longer, they have completely dismantled that constitutional republic. Yeah. And what we're left with is a single party / two party dictatorship.
Yeah. Well, people have been dumbed down, of course, progressively. It's happened through education. It's happened through the liberalization of cultural and moral values. And one has to say, you know, if they know this, you know, again, who's behind it? It doesn't just happen, and when people know it's happening. But it's rather interesting that there was a letter from one Hugh Cavendish in the Daily Mail. It was dated the 1st of October. Mm-hmm. Now, I was rather surprised, very surprised, to learn that this letter had been published at all. But the Daily Mail goes nearest to exposing what's going on. Now, what Cavendish wrote about in terms of political correctness, that it had its roots in the cultural, in the ideological struggle. I don't know how he put it, but this is what it is. The ideological struggle and the schools for social research, known as the Frankfurt School in Frankfurt am Main.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the Rothschild the original source of the Rothschild power, Frankfurt am Main, the School for Social Research. Now, this was where Marx's ideological struggle was put into practice. Now, that goes back to the manifesto, the Communist Manifesto, and basically the revolution was a balance between the armed and the ideological struggle. And in Soviet politico-military doctrine in later years, they were interactive. If you were losing the armed struggle, or there was no tactical or strategical reason to invoke the armed struggle, you turn the other way and introduce the ideological struggle.
Yes, but you know something, Barry, that's interesting, because you're bringing up the Engels-Marx link, and you're also bringing up the Trotsky violence that came from it. But at the same time, there was another ideology that was being passed out, and that was, you take a look at Franco's Spain, you can take a look at the fascism that was being born in Italy, and you also take a look at National Socialism that was being born in Germany. All three of them had their origins in this same group.
Well, I'm not sure I go as far as that, but I wouldn't like to argue it, because, you know, you're putting me on the spot on that particular one, which is fair enough. What I would say is that in Frankfurt am Main in 1923, four men, Franz Horkheimer, Adorno, Marcuse, and Fromm, and incidentally, they were all Jewish. Now, there's nothing anti-Semitic about this. Nobody needs sort of start getting on the horse. That was a fact, just as this thread ran through the Bolshevik Revolution very strongly. Now, their objectives were to destroy the family, culture, religion, morality, and so on, tradition, you see, they would be destroyed. And progressively, and I think it was Gramsci's term, the long march through the institution, the Italian Revolution, the long march through the institution, exactly what they've achieved. Now, moral standards and so on and so forth have been liberalized progressively by people in high places.
Yep.
Now, it has become infused in their own psyche, in their own culture, gradually through the universities, through school education. And this is what has brought us to the present position. Now, what it is doing, and I think Orwell identified this, so did, I can't remember the name, one of the well-known philosophers.
Huxley. Aldous Huxley wrote about it in The Brave New World.
Right, well, he was another one. Yeah.
Yep.
This one's related to the beds. Good heaven, I wouldn't know his name. It's gone just at the moment. But he wrote about we were becoming a nation of sheep. And who something in the way of a rising of sheep, a rebellion of sheep against the practice of eating mutton would become unthinkable. He put this, exactly in simple terms. As it is,
but you know, see, they didn't legislate this. This is the interesting thing that you're going to bring up next here, Barry, because we talked about this. They didn't get their ends met by legislation. They got it through emotional pressure through political correctness. And an example I'll give you is we all know that there are gay people within our society. Has been. If I go back to the beginnings of humanity, however, we never chose it as a first choice within our construct because it was, by and large, an aberration of 10% of our population. Today, what we have is we're not allowed to point out the fact that homosexuality is just that, a 10% aberration of the norm, and that, in fact, it is not a targetable qualitative place that we want to put our society. But if we say that today, all of a sudden we're trying to spread hate. And see, they've done this very clandestinely, and that's one example of many where political correctness has stopped all debate.
Well, it's bureaucracy gone mad, and what you have, of course, are innumerable jobsworths, as we call them. It's their job. You know, if we run down, take very simplistically, we run down British manufacturing industry, and the people thrown up by this, and of course industrial efficiency, automation, and so on. Computerization. We throw up a lot of people. Now, what are you going to do? Are you going to cull them because they're surplus, or introduce, employment in leisure industries and that sort of thing? Well, that happens, but it doesn't meet the overall financial cycle, your balance of payment, the rest of it. Service industries and bureaucracy. And, of course, they have to do jobs, and they apply themselves to these jobs. And they become little Hitlers. They remind me of these Quisling, the Norwegian Quisling, spying on their own, and so on and so forth. And this is one of the problems you have, but it's grown up very subtly. Now, I was talking about this in the air about 2 months ago. I was in hospital with a schoolmaster. He was having a new knee, and I was having a new hip. Now, this is from the man himself. And it must have happened, this is 5 years ago, so it must have happened, I think, at least 10 years before. The legislation had made it impossible for headmasters and school staff. You see, headmaster, I should be called saying head teacher. To say headmaster is sexist. Here we go again. But it had been made impossible for them to maintain discipline. Physical contact became increasingly forbidden until it was out altogether. No physical contact. Now, he was forced to restrain a boy of about 15 in the cloakroom. He was going berserk. Now, either he damaged himself, the property, or somebody else. The headmaster had no option but to stop him. Now, what happened was the headmaster was suspended, and for months he had to live with this charge hanging over him. Eventually, he was exonerated, but of course, it destroyed his career. And the local authority, the local government authority, insisted it remained on his record. Now, this has been accepted. Now, this is so long ago. Now, we repeatedly learn of the same situation. Another schoolmaster, I cut it out of paper the other day, was beaten up by a 15-year-old. at school, and he was suspended while the charge was until the charge was heard. This boy's mates joined up and backed this boy and said that the master had attacked the boy, and there was a picture of the master with bruised and cut or about the face, and he was finally exonerated by the court. But it's too late. If you take another one, the campaign against political correctness in this country just sent a newsletter. It arrived today, and I haven't had time to read it. But in that, you see, firemen, they're now firefighters, the sexist
right.
game. Now, you have situation where fire engines, fire stations are thrown open to the public, or they go to schools, and the children are allowed to sort of clamber into the cabs, put the helmets on, and toot the siren. Lo and behold, it was stopped in one case for fear of abuse. Now, it has become that sick, you see, and you're controlling. What you're also doing is removing individual judgment and individual authority. And this goes back to the same culture of, in education, of anti-elitism and egalitarian. Everybody's equal. And what you do.
Well, Barry, you know what they've done is made men afraid of their daughters. And children afraid of, and you'll see on American sitcoms where the woman is always the overworked intelligent one in the family, and the man is always the imbecile and can't do anything correctly. And you'll see it on British sitcoms as well, where they reinforce the idea that men are stupid and women are overworked and how terrible it is.
In this case, in my view, on some of the reporting and listening, we produce a pretty feeble race of chief constables. Now, these people are equivalent to 2- and 3-star officers in the army. There was a time, and I had lunch with one such 35 years ago, and you could have switched him over without any trouble. Now, they've become enfeebled because they've come through this modern education system, and they don't have the authority, and it's evident. It's evident when you read about these people. The woman who, the deputy or assistant commissioner who was held responsible over this Menezes shooting, this I think it was Brazilian, in the tube in London, during the bomb scare. You see,
right.
The chain of command clearly didn't work. You've only got to read. You can read between the lines. It's really like a book. And this is where the different authority, and we've all, at different levels, had our personal individual judgment and the training for it, the grooming you get in school in the senior form. We've been divested of that, and we've been neutered. And again, we come to this stage, where this point where you say, we daren't say boo to a goose. Now, this is...
Well, Barry, listen to what they did with... But, a country that has the right to bear arms... has the ability to thwart tyranny in its own nation, and what we saw in Australia and in Britain is they vilified guns. They didn't vilify the criminals who use guns, but rather the guns themselves. And then when they were successful at getting rid of the guns from the hands of from your right to have one, then they went after the hunters, and they said people who hunt are criminal. And in fact, they do a service to the livestock in many cases, because without culling certain numbers of sheep of deer, they become rampant in the countryside and they starve.
I think you've got a mixture of bureaucracy, political correctness, and somebody behind the scenes is conducting the orchestra.
That's
Somebody knows exactly what results are being achieved. I'm sure of this. And if you take the case of this headmaster, it's still happening today. People know, and they're doing nothing about it. A lot of it has to do with these rights declarations of the European Union and the United Nations. And, of course, when you look at rights, bloody hell, you talk about children's rights and the rights of people. You look at parts of Africa where there are no rights at all, and or what we've done to the Middle East. And you say, what the hell are we doing? It's very selective. And it is a case of applying these standards, or so-called standards, where it suits the people conducting the orchestra.
It's social engineering.
Well, it amounts to that in the end, yes. I mean, we have this egalitarianism in education. We proliferated universities, and we're producing people with useless, what we call Mickey Mouse degrees, that nobody wants anyway. And they're sent there unable to read and write properly as they used to be. But you see, these changes have been made by people who know exactly what they're doing. And this goes back, right back to Karl Marx, the destruction of society as we know it. And it's been very effective. And you have to say, why aren't people aware of this? Now, today we have police who were shown 10 years ago, it was in the Daily Mail again, they had a two-page spread of the forms, the paperwork police had to cope with. And there have been promises over the intervening period by, I think, both political parties to tidy it up. It's getting worse, I suspect. Now, who allowed this? What are these? What is this documentation for? And you find that the police are increasingly off the streets, in the stations, filling in forms. Now, there's a television program on this the other night. I don't think it'll change a bloody thing. Now, you have police reported as stopping children playing simple games on the pavement. Now, all they've done is put hopscotch lines on the pavement with
chalk. Yeah.
Chalk.
Yeah.
Now, the police come along and they regard it as graffiti. The parents are interviewed and they spend time on this. A little boy had a gun, and because it looked, a four-year-old I think he was, because it looked real, the policeman not only, I think he was threatened with arrest, I can't remember now, but certainly the parents were interviewed, and they were forced to break up this toy. It'd be a plastic toy. Now, we've gone berserk here.
Hey, Barry, they arrested a 9-year-old girl for taking an aspirin at school and arrested her on drug charges. And for distributing drugs because she gave one to a girlfriend, 9 years old, gave a bare aspirin to a friend of hers, and she was charged with drug distribution.
Yeah. You see, we have to ask, why is it allowed? Why is it, does it continue to be allowed? I mean, somebody somewhere at the center of power is blocking this. Nobody is allowing this nonsensical legislation to be reversed, which is why that letter from this chap, Hugh Cavendish, was very interesting because he put a finger on it. And Dr. Frank Ellis, he was a lecturer in history in communism at Sheffield University. Now, he's regarded as a hard right-winger. He lost his job in the end. The man was simply writing analytically. He wrote about 24, 30 pages. He had two articles in a particular journal. I think it was Political and Economic Journal or something of that sort. I wouldn't say it was right or left wing. There are two other terms that he used to divert you from what's going on and the reality. But he wrote about the way Soviet Marxism was used and how it was applied to evolve political correctness, because you take the correct position is that which will further the revolution, that in the interest of the revolution. And this is how it's been exploited, and of course it's been developed bit by bit through these channels to become political correctness. It is a weapon which has its roots in Marxism again, to destroy authority and, again, tradition, culture, family, and so on and so forth. It's been very effective.
Well, and you said early on in this interview that Marxism you can find a direct thread back to the Zionist connection, or in some, we've used Zionism as a catch term here, not to include all Jews, Barry, you know that, but in fact to designate a political movement within a certain group of Jewish people that is not a majority, and in fact it's a minority group. I mean, most Jews today, which I've discovered, are not even religious. In the United States, they're marrying outside of their religion. Yes. They're not going to synagogue. And then there's a group, of course, that is against it. And then there's a small group called Zionists who are actually politically active. They're very wealthy. They're supporting all of these activities with their wealth.
Yes.
And, of course, what we have today is a terrible state of affairs, because this same group is evident in France under Sarkozy and his crew.
Yes.
It's evident in Britain. It's evident in Australia under Mr. Howard. It's evident in the United States, clearly. And where is the resistance? Where is the outrage?
Intimidation. It's intimidation. They intimidate their own. Professor Norman Finkelstein has lost his job, I believe, at a university in the United States. He wrote a book questioning the Holocaust, not denying it. Nobody denies it was an appalling episode, however you apply statistics to it. He wrote, and his mother was a survivor, he wrote a book questioning the dimensions, shall we say, of the Holocaust. Lost his job. And what you have is the Dershowitzes of this world and the Foxmans. They descend and they mobilize worldwide opposition. And then they deny this influence, this power. But it's on record in cases where emails flood in to the point of complaint from Jewish people worldwide. Now, who's mobilized them? They're probably people who don't even know the circumstances of whatever they're complaining about, but they have this ability to mobilize, and then they deny it. But J.J. Goldberg, Jewish himself, after all, wrote a very interesting book. Now, if it's written by, say, somebody with an Islamic background, you look and say, well, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. I've got two books on the shelves, and one is about control of the media and the Jewish influence by somebody of Islamic origin, but J.J. Goldberg, as Jewish, it's a very fair appraisal, but he makes no bones about the way Truman relied on the Jewish vote to get in. Other episodes where people have been kicked out of the House of Representatives at election time when funding has been removed or a campaign has been mounted against them. Now, this is fact. It's not imagination. But if I can go back further, I'm very cautious about taking any particular line with religion, because when you get into religious territory, and I used to write material, that was read by, shall we say, the major religions. Now, I was not going to get too closely involved, because I think religion, in a sense, without going into any great depth, unless you want me to, is a here and now. There has to be faith. There is faith in the unknown. And when religions go head to head, you know, my God is better than yours, or yours is imagination, my God is a real God, then you reach a deadlock, because nobody's going to give way, and you are what you're brought up to be now, or educated to be. Now, I look at infinity, and I say, okay, whether you're agnostic, whether you're strongly religious, whether you're an atheist, explain to me infinity in terms of time and space. Then you can forget the beginning of time or the end of time, because we are looking at something that cannot be explained. Now, this is right, in my view, at the roots of the mystery. Now, from that, of course, we evolve to as it were, provide an explanation, faith. I mean, we can say that thousands of years ago, they may have worshipped the sun or water, because this is what generated the crops, and they didn't starve. So they worship these sort of icons. And, of course, it evolved from there. And it's a very long trail. But I just sit back and say, okay, explain it to me. Come back when you've cracked it. And we've had theologians and philosophers and scientists working round the circle in opposite directions to resolve these great mysteries, the mystery of life, if you like. And they meet at the other side having solved nothing. There aren't any answers. I mean, we've had geniuses, so-called, who've produced plausible theories. They won't answer it. They can't. But you see, when you look at this spiritual angle, you realize that there are more dimensions coming in here. And you go back to Freemasonry, but you go back to the occult and the hidden forces that we simply don't understand. You're back to the country of Blavatsky, Annie Besant at the turn of the last century, Aleister Crowley. Now, I won't mention the name of the correspondent, but I was talking, reading rather, some correspondence in which the Grand Lodge, United Grand Lodge of England, a representative of, was in correspondence with this individual and with a white witch, the head of the white witch coven, or whatever they call it in this country. Now, at length, both factions, both these, the Masonic and the witchcraft, were being taken to task. And my mentor was shown this correspondence, this man I studied under, quite a remarkable man. I mean, I there will never be his like again. He said, look, he said, having read this, he said, the one who is knows least or is on the wrong track is this chap who's stirring these two factions up and arguing with them. He said, the person who knows what she's talking about is the White Witch. Now, my friend in his later years went into religions in great depth and went right back to the unrecorded time of the British Druids and so on, and came through through history, and he knew an awful lot. And David Icke, you see, has made a name going around on lecture tours. Now, David Icke is a late starter. He's very bright, and he's not the clown that some people would imagine. He was given an image of somebody who sort of floated down from the ceiling in, what was it, green smoke, wearing a white, a purple cloak or something. He is a very intelligent, very determined, and he's an extremely nice chap. And he's established himself. I mean, when I met him, he was busy selling his books because he had to make a living. He's not a rich man, or said he wasn't a rich man. In fact, a later book, I edited all but the first three chapters for him. Now, he had theories, spiritual theories, and they were very strong. And he had, interestingly, he has a shape-shifting theory, where even the British monarchy changed shape into reptiles. Now, I think this is a... not literally, I suspect, but you see, I took him to see my mentor, who had done the research in depth, and David Icke was holding forth, and my mentor said, wait a minute, and he went out of the study, and he came back, and he put a pile of books on the desk. He said, when you've read those, you'll know what you're talking about. But that doesn't denigrate David Icke. David Icke has been on the right path, I think, for a long time.
Well, I mean, shape-shifting reptiles, you know, if he's not using it as a metaphor, then he is crackers.
Well, the point is, we don't know. Now, here I will quote to you the story of Dr. Kenneth McCall, who I met. He was in his 90s then. It's some 10, 15 years ago. Dr. McCall had helped with the satanic possession of the daughter of a retired vicar. I met them all. And before the war, he had been going with his wife, they were both missionary doctors, in China, which, of course, was then under attack by the Japanese. And they were approaching a crossroads when a man in white clothing of some sort appealed to them not to go straight on to the hospital where they had work to do, but to turn right and go to a village where they were desperately in need of medical aid for some case of illness or something like that. So they turned and went. And when they turned around, this shape had vanished. This man had vanished. When they resumed their journey and went on to the hospital, they discovered it had been obliterated by Japanese bombers. Now, nobody can explain that to me, but it happened. And while I was meeting Dr. McCall, a lot of other people were there, a local vicar here called on my wife, and he told her a story. He was totally unsolicited. He didn't know where I was going, had gone. He merely called because we were friendly with this man, and he tapped on the door he was wont to do. And he came in, had a cup of tea, and he told my wife about a case of satanic possession in a girls' boarding school. In this country, he also gave her an example of how BBC camera equipment was thrown about in the crypt of a church while filming because they'd moved a sarcophagus to get the right equipment in the right position. No, this was entirely unsolicited, and I think we have to accept that this sort of thing happens, and we don't understand it. Now, in other words, there are forces behind the scenes in some way that have an influence. It's going off at a certain tangent.
Well, I don't see how. I don't give. I don't know whether or not, but that has experience. Those experiences have happened to anybody else. But in my 51 years, there has never been anything that I couldn't explain, even a little bit. When someone tries to tell me that there's shape-shifting lizards that are involved in leadership of countries, what I prefer to think is that these people are basically sociopathic and have skills possibly as rhetoricians and are able to, we can go back to Francis Mesmer and talk about Svengali-like capacities or... Yes. We can discuss the subconscious mind and knowing through MK Ultra how that can be manipulated, or Tavistock, if you will. But we know that LSD exists, and we know that there are ways of using certain conditions, drugs, and experiences to mold somebody. Yeah. So I know that there are people who have bizarre experiences, but in my view, what I see about religion and the use of these supernatural elements within these religious contexts. It is basically to keep people guessing about who's really the power base behind all of these actions. And these people are using these religions. And what I've discovered of late is that the Catholic Church is bought and paid for by these same forces that we've been discussing throughout this this discussion here. And, I mean, when you needed to destroy the Catholic Church, what better way to do it than put a dribbling fool in a glass-encased car and drive him around? Yeah. And have him every now and again drool on people. I mean, what way to pull the strength of a powerful religion and turn it into a mushy pile of nothing than saying its patriarch is just this drooling fool? And it's exactly what they've done. Now, I mean, look, and then we have people within in certain religions supporting the idea that sodomy and buggering people is somehow a proper way for the human family to move forward.
Well, you see, again, you come back to political integrity. Now, we have a minister in the Labour government, Ruth Kelly. Now, she is a devout Catholic. She's had about four ministerial jobs. I call her the all-purpose minister. I wouldn't say, in my view, she's competent in any of them, but she's, I think, Cambridge educated or Oxford educated. And she clearly, is up front with the Labour politicians. Now, when it came to the legalization, almost the imposition of homosexuality, whatever one makes of homosexuality, she was prepared to abandon her religious principles to back the act as a minister. Now, the only honourable thing she, and I believe Blair from his religious background, the only honourable thing they could have done was to resign. They did not. She clung to political power, in effect. Now, this isn't religious observance to me. And again, what is it all about? It's interesting. If you go back, and all one can do is mention the areas of research and get people thinking, because there's nothing can be resolved in an hour or so chatting on the air, as you know. But it's interesting to make these points. Now, the Roman Jewish centurion Josephus wrote his chronicles at the time the Christian religion, Jesus Christ, was about, and it was beginning, of course, to the establishment of Christianity. Now, he refers once in his chronicles, I've got them, and he refers once in his chronicles to Jesus Christ being an itinerant preacher. Now, I can only state that for what it's worth. Now, the point is, if you read the story of Mithras, the fellow in the cap, now this has association with the sun and sun god. And it was apparently what the Roman legions worshipped. Now, in this, one begins to understand that the religious, if public religion, shall we say, the public image of religion is a rather two-dimensional process of belief, whereas the deeper forces are those understood, shall we say, at the time of the Greek philosophers. But behind all the religions lie this, whereas the facade is the conventional religious observant for the mass of the people, who'd never grasp the much deeper esoteric considerations. So you've got a long trail here to follow. Now, the Christian church, of course, through Rome, became the Catholic Church. We don't hear anything of the Essenes. We hear little of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the scrolls that were rescued in, I think, Egypt. Now, I don't know what lies behind them, but it's where the public is told very little. Now, the Catholic Church was an imperial force for 1,000 years at least. Henry VIII decided he'd had enough and destroyed what remained of it in this, what there was of it in this country. Now we have ruined abbeys and so on. Now you have to say, what was this? Why was this major force, an imperial force, so powerful? We're talking about simple religious faith. I only offer.
Well, you know,
but you see,
Barry,
there was
a
to this argument.
There's a story that goes that these two guys are in a sauna together. One of them's a Catholic priest. The other one is a learned man of letters. And the priest says his man named Joseph Campbell, in fact. He was a Harvard professor on religion. And he says, the priest says to him, "Aren't you Joseph Campbell?" And and Joseph Campbell says, "Yes, Father, I am." And he says, "I understand, you know, from your writings that you don't believe in God, Mr. Campbell." And so the Campbell says, "You're right, Father, I don't." He says, and "You're the foremost authority on world religions." He says, "That's interesting." Mm. He says, the priest says to him, "What if I could prove to you the existence of God, Mr. Campbell?" He said, "Well, Father, if you could prove to me the existence of God, what value would there be in faith?"
Yeah, there you are.
And see, you see that that's quite profound, because human beings have an innate, an internal need to get up in the morning and have a faith that their machinations and their efforts are going to somehow secure them for another day. And it starts out at the beginning of that day with faith. And see, as soon as you remove the ability of a human being to feel those faithful urges, then they become lost, and they become malleable, so much so that they'll fall victim to almost anything. And this is exactly what the demoralization process is engendering. Yes. When you demoralize somebody, what you're doing is chipping away at that morning faith that everyone feels.
It comes right up to date. Well, up to date in the modern context, with Karl Marx and religion being the opiate of the people.
Well, isn't that right out of the protocols? Isn't it almost letter perfect right out of those protocols?
What is interesting, I think we need to, I mean, one can get into some very esoteric territory, and I'm certainly no expert, but if one reels forward from the sort of ancient religions and comes up to the 18th century, we have the formation of the Illuminati. Now, this tends to be something of a benchmark in the powers, the hidden powers that be. Now, the Illuminati were, of course, a Masonic-based organization. Now, the Illuminati were exposed by Professor John Robison, a man apparently of impeccable repute.
Yep.
And he wrote Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's dated 1798. I've got an original copy here. I'm looking at it. Now, he talks about Freemasons and Illuminati. Now, he's been rubbish since. Now, this suits people who don't want this understood or followed. Now, do the Illuminati exist today in another form? Has it?
Well, of course. And but see, they use the Illuminati as a vehicle to start the CFR, to start the Trilateral, to start the Bilderberg, to start.
Now, the objectives of the late 18th century are not necessarily the same objectives as we have in the 21st century now.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, we then reel forward a bit the Carbonari. Now,
mm-hmm.
history here, the secret societies of the south of Italy, published
yep.
in 1821, and I'm reading from the fly leaf. Now, they had, and there are diagrams in this book, they had Masonic-type organizations, lodges, the similar layout to a Masonic lodge. Now, there's a knock-on here, and if you read, there are plenty of books about, and again, you've got an enormous field to read. They have a knock-on effect to secret societies in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Abbe Barrowell was another one, four volumes. Now, Abbe Barrowell's history, again, which has been rubbish because it doesn't suit people to be told, but he was writing at the time, and you're more likely to get an accurate report from somebody like that than you are somebody writing today. But it was the same date, 1798, four volumes
yep.
in which he exposes the Illuminati and the power of the Illuminati. It's in volume three, the full exposure. He also
well, you know,
exposes
Barry, you know that people like Voltaire actually wrote about the conspiracies coming out of the Jewish community back when he was the bard of France, and of course. You know, this man uses his great skill in writing to say in no uncertain terms that there is a manipulative element within our society in France that is not in the best interest of the people of France, nor is it in the interest of the world at large, but rather in its own interest. And it moves clandestinely and it criminally envelops everything that in its path. Now, what we find today is nothing very different than what Voltaire talked about. And look at Shakespeare when he wrote the Merchants of Venice. These people were aware that this conspiracy existed over time. This is long before the Zionist conference in Basel, Switzerland. And so basically that's really just the recent change of this group. The Zionism is only its modern face. This face goes back into ancient times, I think.
Yeah, I mean, again, we've been at pains in previous discussions on the air to you know maintain an even keel on this. But what you say is very true. The problem is that the Dershowitz line, the Foxman line, is to go for the jugular of the messenger.
That's
the
right.
ad hominem attack, discredit the source. They
yep.
don't ever explain it. Now, when this power, which is identifiable and quantifiable in the 1920s and 30s, when before the barriers came down through legislation, it was possible to discuss this quite openly. Douglas Reed was a European correspondent of the Times. In other words, he was
yep.
no lower-deck hack. He was a respected senior correspondent. He wrote extensively about this power. Because what you have is increasing control, which prevents people thinking or knowing or discussing. And this is one of the great problems we have. My view is that if you take Israel as a focus of what is going on, a lot of it and the interests of Israel being promoted from within the United States, I'm not interested. Somebody who in modern times has a leg blown off or eyes blown out, it doesn't matter whether they're Jewish or Palestinian in that particular context. They are human beings who didn't ask to be born where they were, ordinary people who are suffering. Now, my view is that when we get onto this anti-Semitic question with the statistical evidence and so on that we've been discussing, is that they should, instead of protest, you know, the favorite terms, outrage and fury, they should be brought to book to explain it. Let them explain it to the rest of us. Not blanket public discussion, smother public discussion. If the evidence is there, let them come and explain it. And I think we've totally been backed into a corner. And of course, political correctness, which removes individual judgment, freedom of speech, and everything else, plays a part in this. But if
you're absolutely right. Barry. You're right. And one of the things I want to remind my listeners to is that I have the Controversy of Zion, Douglas Reed's book, on my website for download. It's part of our database. It is powerful because this man writes from an investigator's standpoint, and he was savage. This man, they did Archibald Ramsey, just like they did Elizabeth Dillings, and like they did the Nesta Webster, and they have been successful through time of destroying the messenger, as you so rightly say.
Once you control the political channels sufficiently. Once you control the media sufficiently, you don't need a majority. You need people, a presence, which will inhibit other people speaking their minds and exposing what needs to be exposed. They're inhibited by, if your colleague, has these particular leanings, then you're going to be put off from mounting any program, any investigation, any discussion, which comes too close to it.
Yep.
Another area which is worth looking at, and all I can do is quote what exists of thousands, Occult Theocracy by Lady Queenborough, Elizabeth Starr Miller. Now, Lady Queenborough published Occult Theocracy in two volumes in about 1933 or 4, and she was dead a year later. Don't ask me how, but,
in a Paris hotel, wasn't she?
I don't know, but you see, she died. Now, very soon afterwards. Now, it's full of secret societies through the ages. Some of the chapters are no more than a third or half a page long. But it's full of information. And again, when you're looking for the threads that are controlling our lives today, you look at the Grand Orient Freemasonry. Now, that was non-religious Freemasonry that went to France with, I think, Bonnypenn Charlie when he escaped Scotland and the Second Rebellion. But it's not the Scottish Rite is not Scottish Freemasonry as practiced here under the United Grand Lodge. The Scottish Rite was this godless Freemasonry, which I believe had its roots in France. And it spread to the United States. And one of the leaders, the principal, was one Albert Pike. Brigadier General in the Civil War, I believe. Mm-hmm. Now, Albert Pike produced a massive tome on this. I can't remember the name, but it's very difficult to read. I've got it. He was in correspondence with Giuseppe Mazzini, an Italian Masonic revolutionary. Now, I have three biographies of Mazzini written, I think, at the end of the 19th, turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I don't think one of them mentions the connection with Pike, and yet they.
Because
in Occult Theocracy, Lady Queenborough reproduces all their correspondence, so it's nonsense. They had no connection.
What we did find, and Rafig and I did a very thorough investigation on the Grand Orient Lodge out of Paris. Being the principal lodge that was set up in Italy, the Grand Orient Lodge of Italy, and that was the jumping-off point for Salonika, the Salonika Greece Lodge that was responsible for the Turkish Ottoman Empire Young Turk invasion that was taken over. And in fact, we did all of the minutia that found its way all the way back to the Grand Orient Lodge of Paris, and we went back in time and found out that who put who in charge of who. Guess who was Napoleon that took over and put in charge of the Grand Orient Lodge, and then it was ultimately Napoleon's family member who took over and was in charge of the Italian Lodge.
Yeah.
And, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
You can't make it up.
Interestingly, in 1824, I think it was, in a book called Fourth Reich of the Rich by Des Griffin, who's a fairly well-known writer, he goes through the whole of the field we've been talking about just about. He mentions the case of William Morgan in the United States in 1826, who began to – he was a fully-fledged Freemason, quite a senior one. He began to write about Freemasonry to expose it, and he was hounded down, abducted, and eventually murdered. Now, if you read Des Griffin, you say, hang on, pull the other leg. This man's a conspiracy theorist. Where's the proof? Well, I happened to be at the Masonic Library about 15 years ago, And it's a very interesting place. And they open glass bookcases on request, but you can't just pull books off the shelves. And in one of the cases, I found a typewritten record of this entire episode. Now, that's in the United Grand Lodge in the Masonic Library in London. In other words, what Des Griffin wrote was true.
Well, how did he get? How does one get access to the Freemason Lodge?
Well, members
library.
Of the public as a Freemason, but one can. I was at the time, or elapsed. I resigned, but later on. But one can go in and as a member of the public, and you know, there's always somebody there seeing over you. I'll give you another one. I found some records of the lodges in Africa, South Africa, before the turn of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Now, we know the Boer War and the events leading up to it went from about 1890, I suppose, to the war
That's
in
right.
1899. Before that, a senior office holder in one of the lodges was a Rothschild.
That's right.
Now, how do we explain that? Now,
well, you don't.
If it's a manufactured name beginning with Rothschild from Frankfurt am Main, then it can only be somebody, a member of the Rothschild family.
Well, and then you know that Oppenheimer came in, swept in behind Rothschild and took over the land that had been expropriated from these farmers. And, of course, you now know that under their land was massive amounts of mineral wealth, diamonds, gold, and whatnot. And, of course, Cecil Rhodes, coming back to Britain, set up the Round Table, which was the forerunner of the CFR.
Yeah. Well, the commander in chief out there, I can't remember his name again. Even though the name's gone. General Officer Commanding in Chief in South Africa was on his own. The commissioner, I think he was, or governor, was back in England, and he warned repeatedly about the plot to generate the Boer War. What became the Boer War?
Mm-hmm.
And he was removed from office. He was sacked. Milner was the man. Lord Milner, I think he was at the time. And he, of course, became very much entangled in the Round Tables and the Royal Institute of International Affairs, as it became. But he was in the thick of it. But you see, it was the general who was sacked for warning of this conspiracy. But if we let me. I think we're probably running out of time and boring the listeners.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
We've
got
all
okay.
the territory. But let
yes,
me quote something that I wrote, and you've got a copy. When I was looking at the a report on the communist councils in New Zealand, where
mm-hmm.
power was going to be developed over the middle classes, basically, to make the middle classes impotent, as it were, economically. And I quoted, on the 19th of November 1937, the Fabian Nicholas Murray Butler, in other words, an international socialist, addressed a banquet in London with the words, "Communism is the instrument with which the financial world can topple national governments and then erect a world government with a world police and world money." Now, that's a very specific statement. It's been quoted quite a lot by other people. And if that statement was genuine, which we have to accept and which I accept, then we are back to the modern age pretty well and what is going on at the time. The progressive centralization of power. The only question left is, what are the objectives of these people ultimately when we have this situation working through the United Nations and, in our case, through the European Union? And where do we go afterwards? And who is conducting the orchestra? Who is drawing all these strings together? Political correctness, which is weakening us, which has its root back to Marx. If you reel back to the Illuminati, it began with the Illuminati in relatively modern times, and it's had this continuity through numerous secret societies in the 19th century to the position we're in today. Now, all one does is say very, very few people have ever come across this research. Nesta Webster in World Revolution, and she was credible enough in 1920 or thereabouts to lecture the officers of the Brigade of Guards and the Metropolitan Police, officially. Now, I've got the papers reporting this. You know, she was introduced by a senior officer, and she was given the floor, and questions were asked afterwards. Now, Nesta Webster produced at the tail end of World Revolution a chart, and it's a bit like a string diagram. It shows all the secret organizations, secret societies, as they were interconnected and interrelated. Now, that was in 1920. It's about the time the book was published. Churchill was a supporter of Nesta Webster, and other people got control of him. But in that, she draws a table at the back also. She's got this chart showing the secret societies and so on. She has a table in the back in which she lines up the protocols of the learned elders of Zion with Illuminism under Adam Weishaupt.
Mm-hmm.
It's a secret society. I'll spell it. My pronunciation is suspect. H-A-U-T-E, V-E-N-T-E, Remain. Now, that lasted until 1848, when you have the uncanny coincidence of attempted revolutions throughout Europe. Simultaneously, the Alliance Social-Democratique, and I think that's probably about... Oh, Bolshevism. Here we are, Bolshevism. Now, there were 24 protocols. Now, I have no axe to grind. Those protocols are regarded as an infamous forgery begun by the Russian secret police in 1905. Now, you can't have a forgery of something if you don't have an original. Nobody seems to know what the original is. It is a term used to condemn them. Now, I don't see the protocols at this point in time attributed to anybody. Because, again...
Well, Theodore Herzl has been bantered around as being one of the authors, but whether that's true or not.
Yes, I wouldn't want to drag in any innocent or any innocent culture or race or creed. This is not the objective. One has to read the protocols and not attribute them to anybody, but say, is this what is happening or what has already happened today? The control of the media, diversion of the people with entertainment and sport, control of the banking system. Now, these are very specific objectives. Now, if they've taken place, fine. Now, one then has to say, okay, you know, it has happened. It was forecast at the beginning of the last century. Why has it been allowed to take place? How has it taken place? And who's been, again, conducting the orchestra, pulling the strings?
Well, you know something, Barry, we have gone from pillar to post on this one here, and I want to let you know that your information and your ideas here are always provocative. And what we need to do here is to my programming here asks people to do research for us. We are a research-based broadcast here, giving people good ideas and roads to go down so that we can further this story in the modern period and link it to the past. And we've done a good job of it, and you've helped me to do that.
I haven't taken you sort of zigzagging wildly from sort of pillar to post.
Well, it's not so bad. I mean, come on. We have done that, but we've done it in a way that I think will jag enough people's interest into getting this further researched, because this is a group effort. I can't do it alone. You can't do it alone. But together we can do it. Together we can look at these issues and inform our fellows of what we find. And that's the goal of the French Connection. And you've been instrumental in helping me to do that. And I want to thank you for it.
Life is a learning process, and one must approach everything without prejudice and take the evidence step by step.
I don't think
there are any conclusions to be leapt at. It's a highly flexible business, and one is learning all the time. A lot of people have been denied access to this knowledge by simply, you know, blanketing it, omitting it, ignoring it. But once people are aware of how much there is to this situation we're in today, then, you know, one might make a bit of progress, because we're up against huge powers these days, consolidation of power.
We're chipping away little by slow here, and it seems to be working. And I'd like to let you know that we get about 16,000 to 18,000 people will hear this broadcast. So That's not so bad. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for listening in on this this most important of discussions I've had with the Colonel Barry Turner, a friend of mine and a comrade in the fight for truth and honesty and not just we don't work, Barry, you and I, from any prejudices except for people committing crimes. I'm prejudiced against criminals, and I have to say that up front. You've been wonderful to come on the show and spend this amount of time with us, and I appreciate it. I hope you can come back again.
I'd be delighted, yes. Oh, yes. I think it's a learning process. One must keep an open mind and be absolutely even-handed in what one says and does and writes and believes.
Well, I concur with that, and I want to thank you again. Ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you to take care of your families and be well. Bye-bye now.
I don't know a soul who's not been better. Don't have a friend who feels at ease. Don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all thank you.